to order the Senate Interim Committee on Education and Workforce Development.
I'll call to order the House Interim Committee on Higher Education.
Looks like you guys have me outnumbered over here.
Slightly.
I have a bill to put away the Senate.
Let's vote.
No vote, no votes.
Records show who's serious about their work.
We're literally down a member today. We lost one of our esteemed members today. And we have a couple out in the hallway and rusting about. We did want to do a unofficial report from the Special Committee on University Governance. Representatives Dembrough and Johnson and I are on that committee, and I think what this calls for is just a brief overview. If you gentlemen want to start.
Well, I'll thank you, Senator Hess. Our Special Committee on University Governance has been about this work for a while now. It's been this was a heavy lift for an interim committee. We met at least every other week as a committee. That doesn't include the multiple meetings that the chairs had to try to work together to try to keep the process moving forward. So we met 10 times, 11 times, something like that. But we went to great lengths to try to create a process that would be open and transparent, where everyone could witness how we went about our work, a very deliberate process, and I think, speaking for myself, but I think the other co-chairs too, I think we feel that the process worked. I think at the end of the day, we came up with a bill draft that is something that accomplishes what we set out to try to do, which obviously was not to create the immaculate bill that is perfect in any sense, but it's a starting point as we move forward into the legislative process in the next session. So recognizing that the legislature will still do what the legislature does, which is try to make things better and more clear and to encompass the desires of the legislature. So with that, I'll pass off to Michael just to get maybe into more specifics and Mark. But I feel good about the work. I feel good about where we're heading. And, again, we're looking for additional input from you all, especially as we still have time left in the public comment period for you all to weigh in, especially committee members. And we hope you'll take the time to do that. And any members out in the public as well, we still have that window of opportunity open for public comment as we move forward. So, Michael.
Great. Thank you, Mark. And let me just add that two other members of this joint committee were on that joint special committee. Representative Springer has been on it, and also Senator Beyer has been on it. And you know, as the senators have said, it's been an arduous process, but I think so far a good one. We are now at the point that the legislation required us to have a draft available for public comment by August 15th, and then there was a 30-day public comment period, which will end tomorrow. And so our comments today are part of that public comment period, and we will, once tomorrow ends, we're going to collect all the comment that has come in. There was some public testimony yesterday in our meeting. There's written testimony that's coming in. We'll review that and try to put together some final recommendations for what will be the last meeting of the special committee, which it looks as if that's going to be on October 4th, I think. Mm-hmm. We know that what we have, so our goal as a special committee is to come up with something that will be essentially a consensus recommendation to the legislature or near consensus, you know. That means that there are going to be some gaps, and there's still some work to be done that will need to be done once it gets into the hands of the legislature as a whole. But we think that we've created a framework here. And at your desk, you have both a breakdown of what's in the bill and the actual draft. It's LC 759. You'll see that the first part is a series of findings. Most of this works off of what was called for in House Bill 4061, which created this task force. We essentially start off by saying that we find that Oregon may benefit from public universities with institutional boards. as long as the following conditions are met, and you'll see those principles. And then we go into the process of attaining a board. The assumption here is that we know that two universities have requested institutional boards, University of Oregon, Portland State University. The legislation as it stands now would, you know, assumes that they will be able to have institutional boards, and it lays out a process for additional boards if other universities would like to request them. It calls for annual reviews by the OEIB, which would come to the legislature to see if these universities with institutional boards are meeting their achievement compacts, if they're meeting the principles that we have laid out here, and that they are meeting the mission of post-secondary education that we have laid out in statute, that's already in statute over the years. There's a section on the makeup of the boards. The governor will be appointing the members of the boards with coming from a list submitted by the institutions, or working off that list. He may choose from outside that list, but the institutions will provide him with the list. The terms of office, lays out the powers of the university. There's a section on tuition. It assumes that the institutional boards will have authority of tuition increases up to 5%. Anything in addition to that, they would need to go to some other statewide entity yet to be named. Or the legislature. There's a section on collective bargaining that essentially continues the status quo. The institutions can issue revenue bonds. These revenue bonds would have to be up to a debt-to-revenue ratio that's under 7%, and it would require review by the treasurer's office.
Achievement compacts.
Yeah, achievement compacts are, you know, they will be responsible for achievement compacts with the OEIB. New programs would have to go through the Higher Education Coordinating Commission, just to prevent the problem of we need a coordination of, you know, the entirety of higher ed, to make sure that they're working together. So those are kind of the broad overviews. Be happy to answer any questions about them. There are a few areas where the draft as it now stands is that is relatively silent, and you know, we still have to work on them. We've not really nailed down the whole area of shared services, right? I mean, everyone, you know, really has an interest in our maintaining a system to some extent, and to make sure that universities are working together to achieve economies of scale, and to to work cooperatively on a number of issues using shared services whenever possible. But we have not figured out yet exactly how that's going to work, and be happy for us to talk about that today.
I think, yeah. What we really did was try to find that sweet spot of letting these two universities reach their highest potential, yet also maintaining the integrity of a state system.
Right.
and there were some compromises made, and I think that's the essence of what's in this draft. There are some things that we didn't and won't probably be able to get to that will still need to be addressed in the next session. Chief among those is the settling in on the governance structure of our higher ed system, and I won't say it's a conundrum, but it's still vexing, and there's probably too many moving pieces that we still have to mm-hmm. I think frankly coordinate better. But because so much of this is new law, things are still settling into place, and it's a little premature to start yanking things out right now. So, but that's on the to-do list for the next session, maybe later. But the legislation that created this task force to do university board governance also said take a swipe at this, and we're saying we're probably not ready to do that yet. And I know Senator Beyer and Representative Springer were on that mm-hmm. panel too, if you guys have any comments or anything to add. Representative Linsberg.
Representative.
Yeah, if this is the nature of a public comment, I would like mm-hmm. to make a public comment. I have tried in various ways to get the task force to take a serious look at a proposal I've had, a special proposal for governance of Portland State. And I'm not sure, I was never asked to testify, and I'm not sure if there was in fact that as a specific piece of business for the task force. If not, I would still ask. And to put it simply, my proposal would be to, rather than create a separate board for Portland State, expand the OHSU board in a way and put Portland State under the same considerations, whatever they were, to facilitate the future of the shared activities of those two institutions. If that has not been a matter of serious consideration, I'd like to ask in my public comment that we find a way to consider that.
Well, we did hear from Portland State on many occasions, but that particular permutation wasn't one that they proposed.
No, it's not one.
So if you'd like to submit that, we'd be concerned.
Well, I have submitted it.
Sure.
I think. And I guess to say politely, it was ignored. And that's okay. This seems the time to be thinking about further downstream than we're thinking about in this proposal.
Mm-hmm. Representative Lindsay.
Thank you. First of all, just a heartfelt thanks for the work that you've done. I know that interim work is, I know you have three other jobs that you're taking care of as well, and you're drinking from a fire hose, so thank you. And secondly, could you, one of you, just kind of give a blueprint of where we go from today to start of session, how we put meat on the bone a little bit?
Well, I'll just chime in. The chairs are going to get together on the 4th. Is that correct?
No, next week.
Okay. The chairs are going to get together prior to the next committee meeting, which is on the 4th, just to try to put a little more flesh on the bones here. There are some parts of the bill where it talks about the government agency to be determined or whatever, something to that effect. We're going to try to flesh some of that out and bring that back to the committee. We found that it works a little bit better if we actually, stick something to the wall and then let the committee take a whack at it for a while and see what stands at the end of the process. So,
and they do.
And they do. Yeah, they're very outspoken. It's worked out really well. So we'll do that. And at the end of that process, what we have then would be a legislative draft that we would then submit as a committee bill, more than likely, in one chamber or perhaps both, mm-hmm. and off we go into the legislative process and have that ready for 13. So, recognizing that there's every opportunity for the legislature to weigh in with amendments and so forth as we go through that process.
We fully expect there will be some refinements.
Yep.
And there'll be one bill, and I think a lot of the work that was done this year will be very helpful. I don't know that we can. So that's how mm-hmm. we'll go in the session.
Yeah. And I'll just add that I'm hoping, with respect to the issue of shared services, that we can get some help with that from the presidents of the universities as well. I think we would be very happy if the seven presidents and the chancellor could sit down and come up with a plan that they can reach consensus on. We all know that getting things through the legislative process is much easier when the parties have come to consensus. So my hope, anyway, is that something like that can happen. Another area, I will say that that is still open, we deliberately have left it open, is the question of who sits on the boards. One of the things that's been in debate is, the role of students on the board, faculty on the board, other employees on the board. The current State Board of Higher Education includes two students and two faculty. Some of us feel that they're, that pattern should be replicated in these institutional boards. Others disagree with that. So that's something that may not get resolved, frankly, until we get into the legislative process.
Senator.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I noticed that in specific, not surprisingly, University of Oregon and Portland State are called out in this. Is there a thought about language to allow others of the seven institutions of higher ed to opt for this down the road? Is it planned to put language in about how they can apply for that?
Yeah, we do. We have provisions for that.
I'm sorry, I missed it then. I apologize.
It was we singled out the U of O and PSU because it was the belief of the committee that throughout the process of our committee work that they have displayed that they are, obviously, number one, they would desire that, and secondly, we believe it was in our judgment demonstrated that they are at that point where that's in their best interest and that they have the ability to function in that capacity. So that's why they're singled out.
No, I got that. Thank you. And I see how I misinterpreted at the beginning of Section 3. Thank you for clarifying.
Representative Hunt.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. I really like how the language in the latter part of Section 6 talks about the institutional board shall attempt to increase tuition rates for tuition and fees by a percentage that's no greater than the CPI. I mean, that's a great standard to have out there. And then, so it seems like there's kind of that goal, and then there's the secondary. But you can go higher than CPI up to 5%, and you're still okay. I guess my question is about the third step beyond that. If they want to exceed 5%, I'm wondering if by having the option of either going to the Education Investment Board or to the legislature, if that ends up increasing the likelihood that will happen because they have two different paths to do it. I mean, functionally, as I understand it, they could go to one, be turned down, and then still go to the other to try and get approval. I'm wondering if that just increases the likelihood that will be pursued, as opposed to just having, especially if we're not talking about publicly elected boards here, which we're clearly not. It seems like just having just the legislature as the option there might more encourage them to be somewhere in the range of CPI or 5%. I don't know if that's been a point of conversation.
Representative Imbro.
I think the assumption is that the legislature will always determine if that is going to be increased. I mean, ultimately, all the OEIB can do is make a recommendation about funding. The legislature retains the ability always to put in budget notes or, whatever. Just so it doesn't change that practice. It just puts in an intermediary step there where there will be a review of the individual institution's decision by some higher board, in this case, either the, by the OEIB with recommendation coming from the Higher Ed Coordinating Commission. And if the legislature disagrees with that, then, that becomes part of the appropriation process.
Okay. But that was certainly a concern of the committee.
and we heard that from multiple stakeholders, from students to faculty to, you know, mm-hmm. so forth, about that concern,
right.
that there be some mechanisms for accountability there. And we vetted that pretty thoroughly in our discussions. We had some folks on wide-ranging viewpoints, so I feel good about where we've tried to steer that conversation.
I do want to clarify that the effort to maintain tuition at CPI also puts some responsibility on the legislature, right? I mean, the assumption there is that the legislature is keeping up with CPI and its funding of
reasonable expectations.
You know, that, you know, that
revenues.
But the assumption is that tuition will be held down, but the legislature has to do its part in maintaining the allocation.
Well, and addressing the issue of cost drivers as well, of course, which we have a fiduciary responsibility to do, and that's one of, I mean, 5% a year, frankly, is too high. Mm-hmm. You know, 5% a year, as far as the eye can see, and you're doubling in a pretty short order, and I don't think that's acceptable at all either, and we certainly heard that from numerous people, so it's kind of a worst-case scenario, but certainly isn't anything I think any of us would feel comfortable saying, yeah, you can have your 5% a year, and you're unaccountable. Is that Representative Lindsay?
Yeah, and just to go on those cost drivers, thank you. I would, since we're kind of having an open discussion, as some of the most identifiable cost drivers that I've studied include graduation delays, mm-hmm. people that are taking 6-7 years to graduate instead of 4. That is a significant cost driver. Also, the shifting or what they call the creeping major. You're 2 or 3 years into your major and you change again. We need to, I hope that we'll have discussions on, and I've been there, okay? But we need to have discussions on incentives to help people get out in time and to make a decision and to get through that decision. A lot of times it's not the student's fault for the creeping major. It's that the creeping major isn't only the student making a decision, but it's majors themselves and the deans of those majors that keep on adding more and more and more, and that also adds to the burden of getting out on time. And so we need to hold the creep down and help put in incentives to get people in and out and to get majors in and out, and that will hold down the cost drivers and get people making hopefully jobs that will increase our revenue and hopefully keep above CPI. So I just bring that out as a discussion that I hope maybe we can talk, I can talk to you independently as chairs, but I hope that we can enter that conversation.
That is such an excellent point. That is, we have talked about that. I think that gets into achievement compacts and incentives, not just graduation delays, but no graduation, where they go 2-3 years at Portland State and they just don't finish. That's unproductive for the state, for the student, for the school, and it's very expensive. It flies in the face of 40-40-20 goals. And so that is a key part of this entire discussion as far as I'm concerned. So thanks for raising.
Yeah, and let me just add that the task force that was created by House Bill 3418, the Student and Institutional Success Act, some of you may remember, has been meeting over the last year or two and is finishing up its recommendations, looking at what some of the obstacles are out there for student success, touching on many of the issues that you're raising, Rep. Lindsay, and as well as others, and how we can do a better job of removing those obstacles. So I believe that report will be ready to be presented to us at our December committee meeting.
And just to follow up, Rep. Lindsay, I think on our next panel, as we have Dr. Crew and Rob Saxton here, I think that would be a proper question to address them as they talk about the achievement compacts that our institutions are going to be held accountable to and how they use that as a mechanism to ensure that that does, in fact, happen. Just one of many things that can be put into those compacts to hold them accountable. So,
yeah.
Very good. Do you have anything to add, Senator?
No.
Really?
Yeah. It's all been said.
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair. One quick question. There's a lot of references to the OEIB reporting, and OEIB sunsets in March 2016, right? Does that affect anything here, or are we just assuming that it's going to be renewed, or what? How's that?
That's a very good point. You know, elsewhere in the statutes, there are there are powers that are held by the OAIB, but if it sunsets, they relegate to the Higher Ed Coordinating Commission. So we probably need some consistency in that. That's a good point.
Representative Harker.
Thank you. I heard actually that it is going to be renewed and named after you.
Thank you.
Not my decision. I'm just reporting what I heard. All right. Couple of things. I like the notion of removing barriers to success in higher ed. I have a concern. One of the concerns that I've expressed before about 40-40-20 is that we not lower the standards for graduation. And when I hear some comments about making sure we can get them in there and out of there with their degrees, because that goes along with 40-40-20, I get concerned again, right? I don't think that's what higher education is necessarily about. It's part of it. It ain't the whole story, okay? Other thing is just clarification for me of some language. Section 6.6a says the board would have is responsible for hiring and terminating all employees of the university. Section 7.1 then says the institutional board needs to submit requests regarding full-time equivalent funding, FTEs. Am I right in thinking that that statement, all budget requests regarding full-time equivalent funding, is for positions on the board? It's not for positions at the campus, correct?
No.
Is it for the board?
Campus.
It's the campus.
Campus budget. They still have to submit a request.
So we would still have a say, a significant say, in the amount of money allotted that the board may allot to FTE funding?
No. I'm sorry. No. FTE funding here is just, I think that's code word for the institutional allocation. It's not tied to number of positions, right?
No.
Yeah. Okay. No, it's just the budget for the university.
Okay.
That's not clear.
I believe we
could take this offline, but I'd like some clarification on that. And I know that this is
a good catch, an
evolving document.
We don't have Gina here, do we?
No.
Yeah.
Ever since Senate Bill 242, we don't determine the number of positions or any of that. There's no position control from the state on universities. And this won't change.
Agreed.
That.
And that's why I was surprised by the language here.
Right.
So
must be a different way to say that. Any other comments, questions? Senator Hass?
I think we covered it.
Obviously, part of the charge of the committee, I think Senator Hass alluded to that, was to make some recommendations to the legislature regarding governance issues. And we will be discussing that further with the committee, but we don't have fully baked ideas, let's just say, about what that's going to look like. We recognize that something has to be done that to make the system more effective and more efficient and so forth and so on, but that is a little bit more of a daunting task, but we will in the end have something that will come out of our work, so stay tuned. So with that, are we ready to move into our next?
I think so.
We have Rob Saxon here.
I was hoping to have
is Rudy here?
And Rudy Crew come up at the same
time. Oh, he's coming at 3. Okay.
So let's move on down.
Mm-hmm. We give Joe Satter time. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Status of need-based financial aid and the opportunity grant, shared responsibility. We have a panel, Josette Green, Tom Reinhart, Michael Savaggio.
Well, maybe we should just...
One at a time?
We might want to break it into two. Because she has... No, is...
Who's all a part of your team?
It's myself.
Oh.
Well,
okay. Yeah, they could come into Yeah, I think they could come up there. You want to come up?
Good afternoon, Chair Hass and Co-Chair Johnson, and members of the House Higher Education Committee and the Senate. Education Committee. I'm Josette Green. I'm the Executive Director of the Oregon Student Access Commission, and it's really a pleasure to see you here today and to have the opportunity to speak with you. I know this is an informational meeting, and I was specifically asked to speak with you about the shared responsibility model and to help to understand the model itself, as well as the state of where we are in the Oregon Opportunity Grant today. I have to tell you, these are some of my favorite topics to be able to share with you, dollars for our students. In order to save paper, you will find the presentation on our website. And that website is at the bottom of this screen, OregonStudentAid.gov, in the section called News. For those of you that are here that might have an iPad or a laptop, there's also a paper by the door that provides that website name as well. I've been in the student financial aid profession almost 30 years, and one thing I've found is to keep it very simple and to make it as easy as possible. Our students become very intimidated by the various details that they're faced with today in financial aid. And so for that reason, I've also attempted to keep the agenda simple here. So I want to tell you a little bit about who is our agency, define affordability with the student, with the shared responsibility model, and bring you up to date on the state of the Oregon Opportunity Grant, and conclude with a discussion on some of the issues facing the Oregon Opportunity Grant today. Oregon Student Access Commission is a very important role when we come to 40-40-20. We're very passionate and excited to be part of the team that are responsible for really building the pipeline of getting students in the pipeline for higher education or education beyond beyond high school. And so we have a mission in that way, is to drive college-going culture for all Oregonians, and we do that through access. Access to our programs, which are primarily mentoring programs to help students prepare for what's next after high school, as well as the financial aid programs. And we'll know that we get there when this state becomes a top college-going state. We know right now that the state is more in the middle to the bottom of the percentages right now. And just one more visual of how we fit in, because we lose students in transitions today. And the loss in transition, you know, can occur when they move from high school and they move from college. And I seem to have a stuck slide here. And so we lose that transition, students in that transition. And so we're that missing puzzle piece to help the students move from middle school, high school, onto what's next. Michael, could I have your help and see if we can move this? If not, it's froze. I'll move on to the next slide. And the bottom line is that OSAC advocates for all students. So regardless of sector, we work with all students in that regard. So to share with you a little bit about the shared responsibility model, it is a definition of affordability in the state, and in that definition comes a philosophy as well as a calculation for this. And so just so I get a feel of your experience, how many of you were involved by show of hands in the shared responsibility model conversation in 2003 to 2007? About one person. Okay. Thank you, Representative Greenleg. So again, two purposes, and I'm going to move on to the next slide that's called SRM components. So the conversation actually began in 2003 about the shared responsibility model, and it was done during Governor Colin Galski's term. He was wanting to infuse the program with additional funding, and yet wanted to be sure to ensure that our students and families were contributing to their college education. And hence, the shared responsibility model was birthed. And in this model, as you see on the example here, we take the cost of education, there's four components here, the cost of education, determine the student's share, what the family can contribute, and the federal share. And then from there we have unmet need, which then becomes the state share. So philosophically, it's to demonstrate that families, students, have first responsibility in providing. And then the federal government, and when no one else, then the state can step up. This also becomes the formula for determining the amount of the Oregon Opportunity Grant. Initially, when the program shared responsibility model came to life, the intention was that unmet need you see here, that full amount, would be the amount of the grant for the student. In today's world, however, that has not been the case, and the Oregon Opportunity Grant has continued to have an award maximum each year. So you'll see that on the next page. Just to give you an example of how this works for our students. So our students coming to school this month, 2012-13, full need students. This example is for students with full need. There is a cost of attendance varying by four-year students, or four-year schools, or two-year schools. And you can see in each example the subtraction out of the student share, family share, federal share, therefore giving an unmet need. Now, you'll see that the unmet need between two-year and four-year students is very similar, and that's simply because in the four-year calculation, student share also includes loans. We have used this model every year since 2008-2009. And you'll notice that if there's a difference then between the unmet need or the state share and the opportunity grant award, then it's left to the student to make up that difference. So you can see that there's a big gap there. We're already in the calculation asking our students to contribute. It could be a contribution from loans, work, scholarships, institutional aid. But now in addition, in today's world with the dollars that we have, they have to make up that additional gap. The next slide you'll see.
This example is a single year, is that right?
It is, yes. Thank you for the question. The next page is projected student impact. I took this from a fact sheet I found from 2007 that enumerates the various goals of the shared responsibility model. And I'll quickly read through these and like you to keep those in mind as we then move on to the Oregon Opportunity Grant and an understanding of that to see how these fit in today. So the first one was to increase the number of eligible students while continuing to assist the currently eligible students. Extend the grant to the middle income, increase the average grant size, assist half-time students, enable students with financial need to be able to work their way through college with lower borrowing amounts for many students, and then help to increase educational attainment to the state, kind of the mini 40-40-20 back then. So that's, in essence, the shared responsibility model. Again, it's a philosophy for how we approach our need-based grant in this state, as well as helps to calculate how much a student's awarded. If it's not working, that's okay. Okay. So the next section, the Oregon Opportunity Grant, to share a little bit about where are we, what is it, and where are we today. The Oregon Opportunity Grant is the state's only need-based grant. I'm going to be sharing with you some data, and I'm sharing a lot of data with you because I think it's the most objective piece of information to really understand where we are in the world today with the Opportunity Grant. So you're going to see a lot of statistics and information. At the Task Force on Higher Education, Student and Institutional Success, Representative Dembrow had seen some of these pieces of information and asked that I share this with you as well. So I'm very pleased to say before I get into explaining the grant program that in the past couple years we've very effectively, OSEC has very effectively managed the program in accuracy, and we've taken a rather conservative view on the administration of it, but it's been a very effective view so that's administered efficiently going forward. Before I even talk a little bit more about that, I first want to say thank you to each of you on behalf of our students. Thank you for two reasons. This last legislative cycle, it was a tough one. The economy has declined. You were all faced with some very, very difficult decisions. And in the midst of all of that, you supported our students with the Oregon Opportunity Grant. We did not see a decline in funding. In fact, we saw a slight increase from before. And to that, I really want to say on behalf of students, thank you so much. Not all states, viewed the grant in that same way. Many eliminated or reduced significantly the grant fund, so thank you for our students. Now, as we go forward, the picture is not pretty, but I think we have to keep in mind the situation that the state has been in. And second of all, thank you to each year that we get the opportunity grant funds out to our students as quickly as possible increases the value to our students. Our students are making their college-going decisions in January, February, March, April of each year. And it's actually very amazing, having worked with other states. In this state, the co-chairs of Ways and Means have been terrific, and many of you, to ensure that we, even before the budget for the state is put together, we have a commitment can move forward in awarding our students in March prior to the budget being completed in June. So it's that collaboration and that work relationship is invaluable to our students. So I say thank you for that as well. And we'll be coming around again this next February, March to, again, have those conversations. The next slide now really gives the full story in one slide what's happening with the Oregon Opportunity Grant. It's a slide with blue bars on it, red line and green line. The Oregon Opportunity Grant funds versus eligible applicants and grant recipients. The blue bar is the dollar amount for that biennium. And you'll notice while the dollar amount for 11-13 is the actual amount, the additional numbers of applicants and recipients are estimates. The red line is the number of eligible applicants. And you can see that red line since 2008-09 has just skyrocketed. And this is a trend around the nation. When the economy tanked in 2008, students went back to school. While the red line has continued to go up, we are beginning to see just this next year a leveling off of applications and for our students.
Mr. Chair. May I ask a clarifying question?
Certainly.
I had a group of Portland State students in my office yesterday who told me only 20% of the people who qualified got the grant. That couldn't be right, but that's what this looks like. Is that about 80%, 20%?
Co-Chair Johnson, Chair Hass, thank you, Representative Greenlee, for that question. Indeed you are, and you're already prompting my next slide, too. But yes, currently in the 11-12 year, 18.6% of our eligible students received the grant. 18.6. So I'll give you a little bit more information. Okay. And maybe I have PowerPoint back.
Josette, is that a number, 18 point, were those of applicants or just simply eligible students?
Those are qualified applicants.
These are qualified applicants. They've actually turned in a request for aid.
Yeah, thank you, correct? Representative Johnson, for the question. Those are the eligible applicants who receive far more applications than the eligible applications.
And that's against only $1,000 grants as well.
Okay. Thank you for knowing the program. And so you see here the green line are the actual students who receive that. And you can see that that line has stayed flat. So that divide, that gap continues to grow through the years. Oregon has the earliest priority deadline in the nation, and we were recognized for that this past year in Smart Money magazine. Not a recognition I was necessarily proud of, but we were recognized because we have the earliest in the nation. We award the money currently on first-come, first-serve status, and what that's meant is that students that get their applications in January, this past year we ran out of funds around January 31st, about halfway through that day. So we didn't quite get to February 1st. Having an early goal like that creates some behaviors among our students. Our students have learned, and it's changed their behavior, particularly in the community college segment, that those students get those applications in as soon as possible. Many, of course, at that point in time, estimating their income just to make sure they get in line for this grant. This year, for 12-13, 60% of our initial awards were to the community college sector, and the rest the next majority to OUS, followed by the private schools.
Josette, yes. Mr. Chair, if I can just jump in. And of course, you know, the downside to that is that not all students in the previous December or January know that they're going to be going to school, that they're going to be wanting to go to school, that they're going to have lost their job and need to go to school, and they're essentially shut out of the process for, you know, for that in for the current year and the next year.
Mm-hmm. Co-Chair Johnson, Chair Haas, thank you, Representative Denver, for that question. You're absolutely right, and that's the dilemma that the Commission continues to deal with if we're able to meet 18.6% of our students' needs or the eligible students. In what way do we award that? And we struggle with that because right now we're awarding those students who have given some thought, who have planned, who are simply just jump the gun and hurry and get it done. And we have those students, as you suggest, that due to perhaps quickly losing their job, and now it's August, and they'd like to go to school in September, and their state is not able to support them now. But where do we put that 18.6%? What population do we help? So we struggle with that. And now in our conversations today about completion, should we be redesigning to drive completion? And that might look completely different and not reward the early appliers and not reward those that come to school late. It might be a different population. But it's what we struggle with in this current situation with limited funds and an increased applicant pool. We are proud, however, to say that this past year we awarded the students the earliest ever. We did that on April 17th. It's easier to do on the even years simply because we better know our funding. But we were able to award them February 17th. April wouldn't be that early, would it? February 17th, therefore giving students knowledge of their award and able to make very capable decisions for their future. And in addition, the agency also provided emails to students to notify them of their awards. Again, we're all about access, getting students to access. We found when we surveyed a group of students the year prior that 30% didn't know they had an award previously. And it could simply be because those students applied for the FAFSA, never completed an admissions application, and therefore never heard directly from the school, which is what's happened in the past. So we are continuing to strive to improve access in this program in light of the funding that we currently have. So the next slide, well, we'll just go from paper. So the next slide, you'll see more of the detail, and that's why you have full screenshots in your handout. You'll see the full screen here. The top portion of the screen is the number of eligible applicants, so you can better see some of the detail that went into the previous screen. The next third is the number of opportunity grant recipients. The final section, and this is where I want to direct your attention to, the very bottom line, represents the percent of eligible students who actually receive the opportunity grant. You can see in the early years it went from 42% to 40% to 53%. If you continue across the screen to the bottom right-hand corner, you see the 11-12 year, which was 18.6%. If we retain the same funding and the same applications, we would be continuing in this path going forward.
Can you explain what happened in 2010-11 for that dramatic decrease?
Yeah. Co-Chair Johnson, Chair Haas, thank you for the question, Representative Denbro. What happened there in the 2009-11 session, not session, but in that biennial year, it happens that a majority of the dollars were spent in the first year of the biennium, and therefore leaving a lesser amount for the second biennium. And that's why you see such a discrepancy in numbers and percent.
Mm-hmm. And if I could just jump in and make a comment. You know, we had a public hearing last night on the draft report of the Student Institutional Success Task Force. And we were asking people in attendance, many of whom were students, you know, if they had had issues with the opportunity grant that we should be focusing on. And one of the big complaints was what was perceived to be the erratic nature of it, you know, that they had it 1 year, and they assumed they would have it the next year, and then they didn't. And that was extremely disruptive for them. And I suspect, just looking at those numbers, that many students who had one in 2009-10 then did not have one in 2010-11, maybe got one the next year, but are completely uncertain about what's going to happen next year. Mm-hmm. So, and that was a real problem for them, their inability to plan.
Ms. Chair, if I could add to that, I thought the promise of the shared responsibility model is that we'd be making promises of what they could expect over their whole college career. Was that not a basic element to that?
Co-Chair Johnson, Chair Haas. Thanks, Representative Greenlick. I will have to do some research to see if that was indeed a promise. The fact sheet that I shared with you were some of the original goals that the program had, but let me do some research. I will have to say it's not a commitment that I'm as familiar with. It doesn't mean it didn't happen then.
I wish you would, because I'm sure it was what we built in.
Yes, in our current situation with the funding as it is and the large number of applicants, it makes it very difficult, unless we redesign. And that's some of what the discussions are currently. Do we need to redesign so we can make a level of commitment if a student has received the grant the first year, that we commit that they receive it, give them priority to receive it the second year? So it's some of the discussions that were taking place right now.
Excuse me, Josette, we need to come to a completion here pretty soon.
Okay. Thank you. All right, the next screen simply just talks about the maximum opportunity grant awards over time. And you can see, again, one of the SRM goals was to increase the dollars to our students. But because of the increased number of applications, the agency has simply tried to provide more dollars or lesser dollars to more students. The next screen I'm going to pass by, it simply breaks down the dollars by college sector. The next screen, average OUS tuition fees, begs the question, what is the purchasing power of the opportunity grant for our students? Now, these numbers come from OUS. I think we'd see the same kind of bar graph from community colleges, but you can see the costs going up, but the purchasing power of the dollars stays flat. The next two screens I'm going to pass by because it breaks it down, looking at the opportunity grant as a percent of cost of attendance and as tuition and fees. Again, making the same point, our students have reduced purchasing power in their program. Then I moved on to demographics to tell you a little bit about who are the students receiving the opportunity grant. 62% in 12-13 are independent students. And you'll see by the grade level breakdown that the majority are in their first or second year of school, which makes sense when you blend in the community college students. One of the questions raised, or one of the goals of the shared responsibility model, was to also fund middle-income families. So I provided you a breakdown of opportunity grant recipients by income ranges. If you look at the higher income ranges in more recent years, you will see that there are families receiving the money in that era. My very last slide talks about some of the issues today. I think the number one issue, probably no surprise, our students need more money. There's simply not enough money to help them today. What about funding late entry students, not just the early applicants, plus many other populations? What is the purpose of the opportunity grant? We're in an era of 40-40-20 that talks about completion. Should the opportunity grant be to drive access? Is it for completion or a hybrid? Perhaps both. We also have a lack of research to really understand what are the outcomes that we're currently receiving from those, and Representative Denbro talked about that earlier. And then effective utilization of the shared responsibility model in today's current environment. To really utilize the shared responsibility model, we need sufficient funding to meet the unmet need and to comply with the state's share. We're not doing that. And last but not least, an element in today's financial aid world is how could we provide hope, simplicity, and inspiration with the same amount of dollars? Our students today, they don't know about their financial aid until the last term of their senior year. For our foster youth, we've given a promise. They know early on that they have a promise now of tuition and fees covered at state schools. How can we use money that early on we can give hope and promise to our students? So I'll close with that. Thank you very much for your time, and I certainly, if there's any time left for questions, would entertain any.
Why don't we have her stick around?
If you wouldn't mind just sticking around, we'll go have our next panel, and then if the committee would like to hang out and ask a few questions later, we can do that. Thank you, Joseph.
Be glad to do so. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
With that, I think we'll call up our next esteemed panel. We'd like to call up Dr. Rudy Crew and Rob Saxton. Thank you both for making the time to be here today.
Yes. Thank you. Good afternoon, Co-Chair Johnson, Co-Chair Dembro. It's a pleasure to be here this afternoon. For the record, I'm Rob Saxton, Deputy Superintendent of Public Instruction, and I get to take the word acting off of that title for the very first time publicly, and just want to, you know, certainly take this opportunity to thank Governor Kitzhaber for the appointment and for the support of the House or the Senate today, and specifically for Senator Haass and his support on the floor, and also for Senator Burdick. Very nice words today. Thank you very much. So it's a pleasure to be here, and feel like there's a real honor and a huge level of responsibility. Very excited about what we have going on in education in the state of Oregon. I think it's something that really is unprecedented, and it is our time, and it's time for us to pick this up and move very quickly. I would tell you that because I did have the title of acting, I have had the opportunity to be at the department since the 31st of July, and it has been fast and furious since I arrived there. One of the things that I know is absolutely true, and you all know too, is that one of the things you have to do right away is get great people on board in really important places of leadership in order to begin to make some positive changes in an organization. And I have been able to do that in some very key positions, and I'm very pleased. And I know I've said this in some other places, but I'm very pleased to tell this committee that Heidi Seip, the superintendent from the Umatilla School District, is coming on board and will be leading what we call EII, what I would call as a district superintendent, our curriculum instruction department. And some of the work that Heidi has to lead is some of the very most important work that the department has to do as we move forward with our agenda in the upcoming year and in years to come. I also have had the good fortune to bring on Sarah Pope. Sarah will be acting in a chief of staff capacity, and also will be working on communications, and comes from Stand for Children and most recently OBA. And then also have been able to bring on a woman named Patria Hagen-Gilden, who Representative Greenlick had an opportunity to meet today. And I'm very pleased. Patria was the director of special education in the Tiger Tualatin School District, and in 1996 served as the assistant superintendent in the Department of Education in that role. And Patria is a wonderful person, and will be a great leader as we begin, as I said, this transformation. One thing that I have not been able to do thus far, and it's something I continue to work at and I want to make progress on right away, is be able to attract the right person into the position as the ESD czar, or whatever title that somebody wants to call that. It's a little bit awkward to call it a czar, but nonetheless, I think that is the title that is commonly referred to or by, and I will continue to work at that very hard. I think it's an important position as we look at our ESDs and potential reform of our ESDs as we need them and an organization there that can help us partner and carry out the agenda that we have to carry out. Several different things have happened. One is that because Oregon has undertaken this work, and because we've had some great leadership from folks here in the state, and we've been able to get a waiver from the federal government to No Child Left Behind, and that waiver comes with some very specific requirements. And a couple of those, one is we need to rework the Oregon report card. And we're in the process of reworking that report card now. We've got people lined up and some committee work that is about to be undertaken. We'll be out in the state talking to people about what it is that they need this report card to do and say. We think it's really important that it is a great report that's easily accessible for all people as they look at it and clearly communicates about their child's school, their child's district, and compares it to other districts so that people can look and say, I understand in a really nice, easy way exactly what my child's school looks like. And then has a back end electronically where there's more information available, but very specifically information about that parent's individual child, where they can get online and say, this is where my child currently sits in their process of being a successful graduate, in meeting the requirements, and how they compare with other students, and also offer some ideas and suggestions about how we might be able to engage that parent and what the child needs to do in order to be successful ultimately as they move through the system. And so that's a very exciting piece of work. We have created a new way of looking at and identifying schools as priority schools, which are schools that currently need the most support. There are Title I schools who are performing in the lowest 5% of our title schools. And part of one of the things that the department will be able to do is to support those schools as they move through a process so that we can help them get out of that status and have much better success with their students. The next lowest performing 10% are identified as focus schools. And again, the department will be involved in that and helping with that work. And the top 5% are called model schools. And really what we want to do is look at those model schools and understand what is it that they're doing, and especially if there are things that are common that those schools are doing that we can replicate in all schools, but in particular in our priority and focus schools. So that's some work that we have going underway. I would tell you that that waiver provides an avenue for the department to become about service. And oftentimes the Department of Education has been really about making sure that people meet federal requirements, and so we've been much of a compliance organization. This gives us an opportunity to move into support, and we're very excited about moving into that area and working with those priority and focus schools. And that will be, we've begun that process. We've had meetings, we've had workshops, we've had webinars, and we'll be having more as we move through the year. We've assigned coaches to those schools, and we've done and are in the process of doing evaluations of those schools so that we can understand how to best apply resource and effort. And we're very, I'm very pleased at the work that's going on there, and we're going to make sure that it's good work. We also are working in the area of teacher effectiveness in this and teacher evaluation. And I know that you all know about Senate Bill 290 and the work that is there. And we've begun doing some training across the state, and we have some on the 26th and 27th of September with all schools where we're meeting and talking about, you know, here are the requirements of 290. This is what this looks like in evaluation. We know that everybody needs to have a model in place by next July 1, needs to pilot that model over the course of that year, and then have that in place by 2014, July 1, 2014, as we move forward. And again, it's a place where the department can play a support role. And so there are all kinds of things happening with that, and I probably will stop there and turn it over to Dr. Crew, and I'm sure that he's going to want to talk about some of the, you know, some of the birth to 20 and some of the transitions that sit in there, especially with the conversation that's been taking place in the committee today. Dr. Crew.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Rob. Good afternoon. excuse me. It's a pleasure to be with you again and to have the opportunity to speak about some of the fundamental and critical issues that are going to be under the umbrella, if you will, of OEIB, and specifically in terms of the work that I envision myself and the team, along with Rob and others, now as a part of the P20 continuum, beginning to really focus upon. It stands without reason that we will need to really look at, as has already been presented to you, the causes and the interventions necessary to create a different outcome in terms of the places where we have not transitioned kids very well throughout the 0 to 12 system, and as the young people go from 10 to 14 or even into higher ed, that we seemingly both as a state and as a nation have a trouble in being able to see large numbers of youngsters as they go through the system transition effectively and not lose students en route. If you follow cohort analysis and see what it looks like for ninth graders going to 12th graders, we lose students. If you look at entering freshmen to their senior year, we lose students. If you look at incoming young people who are birth to third grade proficiency, we lose students. The eighth go ninth trap, if you will, we lose students. We've got to understand that more profoundly and actually spend some time and effort really intervening in the behaviors of the institutions that cause that gap to exist. When people have referred to the achievement gap, in my judgment, we're really talking about a strategy gap. The idea that we just don't know how to hold on to, find, track, intervene in the lives of, provide services, early identification, get ahead of the curve of lots of young people who, when they get to these points of transition, they are fundamentally ill-equipped, know that they're ill-equipped, and they make the choice, in many cases, to leave us. And we have to find a better way of being able to identify and work with those youngsters prior to the time that that gap comes. Yesterday, I had the occasion to talk at some length about what I think some of the critical variables will be en route to that, to changing some of those kinds of outcomes. I would say that under the aegis of the OEIB board and the governor, and in a configuration of lots of the new and different kinds of boards that will be now on the landscape as a result of the new law, the work has to center, in my judgment, the work has to center on some really recognizable, measurable, very specific bodies of study and work that are going to ultimately be the way that we have this conversation across the entire system. And the first body of work really is about reading. I can't stress the importance and the distinction of this particular discipline as being the sort of most critical among others, including mathematics and science, including social science. But students who have the ability to function with language, to use language in ways that powerfully not only explain who they are, what they think, and how they think, but it is ways by which they ultimately create new and different meaning out of things that are coming to them in content, in science, in the sciences, in mathematics, in social science, in interdisciplinary studies, in everyday life. And somehow their confidence, by virtue of this one skill, is buoyed enough that they take on high-level challenges in other disciplines because they fundamentally can read with comprehension. There is probably no more seminal discipline, no more critical idea about learning than that which is grounded in this notion of, can I understand how language can facilitate my mind and my thoughts? And to that end, a lot of the data points that we need to look at will obviously be some of the OAKS tests results and so on. But frankly, we're going to want to look at, you know, what is it that teachers see every day in their classroom? What new assessments are they using? What other ways by which to understand what's happening with young people in their ability to read? The students that you see not making it to a post-secondary institution, the students that we see not being able to even give rise to new thoughts about their career readiness or their career interest, are kids who fundamentally never believe that they can get beyond the current status of their life because they can't read. And we have this system in this state, and I would say this was true in other states as well. We have a huge, huge degree of variability in our production of young people who are very good, very skillful, very good at the idea, very good at reading, can read with comprehension early in life, and they do it early and often all the way through life, versus those who do not. I consider that to be a kind of a, you know, there's no business or industry that could stand that level of downside variability. It's just too enormous. And we've got to shrink that. And the tabulation of the boards, the keeping score by many of the boards that have been created, the OEIB and others, is really about, at least in some measure, really asking the question, are you taking a bite out of that crime? And we need to do that. Rob is going to need to do that. I'm going to need to do that. We're going to need to create a culture in the state where we understand that this is a seminal, if you will. If people talk about this in terms of social justice, I've heard them talk about this as the civil right of our era. I've heard it in lots of different ways, both rhetorically and not. Truth of the matter is, this is just an essential part of being a human being and understanding and using the democracy available to us in this country. And to the degree that we actually give people that on board, we are actually making them citizens, making them enabling them to be real citizens of our democracy and of our world. That's a big body of work. I was just today in out in the tribal council gathering that the governor has convened, the governor-to-governor, government-to-government council with the native tribes, and had the occasion to listen to a number of stories about how completely disaffected, how completely bereft the students are who, as Native students, go through systems that in many cases, I wouldn't say all, but in many cases, are non-readers. And that as a result of that, they have high rates of not only unemployment, but high rates of incarceration, high rates of alcoholism, and so on and so forth. Our intent is to stick our finger in that problem and to intervene in that problem. To behave differently means to really look at ways by which these institutions now talk about, see, intervene, use dollars for, commit to resources for, use our intelligence and our ultimate knowledge in universities and so forth for being able to intervene in this. On the other hand, I left there and went to McMinnville and had the occasion to meet with the superintendent and the now principal of the year. I probably got to see what I would consider to be arguably one of the top tier schools in the nation in going through that school. I got a chance to listen to a principal who is nothing short of brilliant. She's far too modest. She'll probably never want to come to a committee meeting, but in my brief meeting with her, I was so deeply impressed, not just by her commitment, but by her technical knowledge of what to do about how her school has performed, how their children have performed, very high ELL population, very high SES population. They beat the odds every single year. There's something good and strong about what they are doing in that school. We've got to actually have what she's doing become part of what's happening for many of our Native students in this state, and frankly, many other students across the state. So this idea of reading is one bucket that I think we're going to be in. I'll be very brief about the other three that I think are equally as challenging. STEM's work is on our doorstep. It is global in its nature. It is characteristically complex. It offers us linkage opportunities to the world of work, to post-secondary pursuits, to readiness, if you will, for career challenges as well as college challenges and entry. But we don't, in my judgment, have in the state a real specific, deep, and probing on-ramp for students to get to those opportunities. If you happen to be good in science or math or technology, and you happen to like it, you're golden. If you really fundamentally did not get the foundational skills in mathematics early on, you're going to be looking at a gap that you now begin to see in some of the data that just came out that Deputy Superintendent Saxton talked about at the beginning part of this week. It's, again, it's this sort of tale of two cities. It's the best of times for some and the worst of times for others in mathematics, in science, in technology, and the like. There's excitement about all of those content areas. There's real joy in being able to know how to, you know, move and understand photosynthesis at a level that you actually can create these things and these opportunities for young people. But we've got to do it at a much deeper level, and I am looking at the idea of creating STEMS lab schools that work either on or in conjunction with university campuses. The notion that we have lots of people in schools of engineering, schools of science, schools of mathematics from the university community, from the higher ed community overall, but also from our own high schools, that if we put them together, boy, what a school that would be. What a place that would offer. In New York City, that was Bronx High School of Science. What it meant was that you got an opportunity to go to a first-rate school that when you left there, you had enormous cachet as you went forward into post-secondary, or if you went into the world of work even. I mean, people wanted to know, where did you go, and why that school had such an incredibly powerful reputation was that it had all of these linkages. I think we need numbers of those. We don't need one. We need a lot of them. And we need to pay attention to this issue of STEMS as it relates to content delivery and a stronger basis upon which it's connected to the world of work and to post-secondary. The other area for me is that I think we're going to spend some time on it is this building of parent and community connectivity to the idea of strengthening the hand of teachers in school, but doing it by virtue of the leverage parents bring into the equation. I think we have underplayed our hand. We have actually gone soft, if you will. I don't mean this state, but just generally we've gone soft in what we think we can expect from parents, what we are asking of parents, and then what they in turn are asking or, if you will, demanding from us. That's a really, really powerful, for me, conversation, and it's one that ultimately may lead us down the road of having very different kinds of relationships, very different kinds of structures, high use of technology, of being able to give parents a different kind of menu of options for how they can help their young people at home, maybe some technology and online services about, you know, sort of what do I do when my son is struggling in a content area, or what do I do when I'm thinking about college and career? What do I do when I notice that my student has missed 15 or more days of school? We've got to have a conversation with them as though they are, in fact, the market that we serve. There are lots of choices in this market, and therefore the public schools are not the only ones. And so to the degree that we actually recognize this, talk to people as though they are engaged and will be engaged if we actually connect them to these skills and to these understandings, then it seems to me we'll be able to have a more engaged parent, a more advocating parent, but also a better student who's really ready to come to school and sees the connectivity between what they do at home and school. And last, and certainly not least, the work that I envision this team to be about will be the development of and the support for teachers and teaching. The country has had a really sad, sort of almost fickle affair with teaching and the profession. We have wanted it upon occasion to be the creme de la creme, attracting people from walks of life, from all manner of disciplines that would come and be and add the intellectual sustenance to the body of work of teaching a young person. And then over the last 20 or 30 years, we've actually kind of whipsawed the profession in such a way as that it's gotten unclear messages about what they're supposed to really do. Is this about creativity and how young people will shape their thinking? Is this about a number, a test, a one-digit specific end game that, you know, all of my work is going to ultimately be revealed by the measure of an Oakes test? Or is this about being able to create opportunities for young people and connect them to those opportunities beyond the grade that I am teaching in or beyond the school that I'm teaching in. In some ways, we've in some cities, certainly, they've dumbed it down. They've essentially allowed this to become a profession that essentially just kind of responds to the lowest common denominator, to the highest political problem, and that we are simply respondents to the problem. I would argue that the attention given to this is going to be not different in many respects from the attention given to reading. These are co-equal solutions. We need to ultimately spend some time thinking through the relationship of colleges of education, deans of education, the ESDs. All of these are central institutional players to the efficacy and the design and the development of a structure and a support system for getting the best teachers to be the best that they can be in the context of a classroom. America is losing, in many cases, if you look at the NAEP scores, we lose the race not because our kids aren't smart or not because they don't have the opportunities, but because many times they are not necessarily sitting in classrooms where mathematics is taught by somebody whose primary skill was mathematics. And the like. And we've got more and more and more people who want to be, and in my mind, are very good and very competent at what they're doing, but they could grow in it, and they should be able to grow in it, and they should do it as a state, and we ought to invest in how that growth takes place. And I think you'll find that it has a one-to-one correlation with the way in which the scores move, the changes in how students achieve, and ultimately the changes by which they attack, if you will, the colleges and universities and career choices that they make. So those areas really represent the buckets of work that I think are really critical for right now. I do think that they, you know, as this conversation shapes out budgetarily, I do think that they represent some sort of the strategic sort of framework of the OEIB and the conversations that we'll be having there. I think that this is not going to ignore issues of special needs, issues of gifted, if you will, children. We're not going to ignore the issues of how the arts play an important part in the shaping of cognition, the design and the development of cognition. But we are going to ultimately say, at the end of the day, we're going to be measured by whether or not we actually produce specific ways of intervening in the problems that I started this conversation with. I want you to hold us and the entire body of work that we do accountable for the kind of intervention in the behaviors that didn't get us those outcomes, and rather now in the creation of behaviors that do. So thank you very, very much.
Thank you both. Good comments. I know we can have a lot of questions here, and we're not going to exhaust it today. We'll be seeing you from right. from here on out. That's true. I'd like to just dial in on one area, though. I think you gave a great overview of our entire public education system and how we can improve so many areas, and obviously that was the context and is the premise behind the creation of the OEIB and this P20 continuum and so forth and so on. But specifically as it relates to higher ed, I wonder how, if you could just comment about the Achievement Compact process and how you can envision that being used to drive achievement, to drive outcomes, to drive better measures for all of Oregonians through that process and the relationship with the OEIB.
I think that the compact idea is both novel and highly, highly useful for driving what I think of as less the outcomes and more the conversations that get to the outcomes. This is a dynamic, and the question of transformation and outcomes-based work is about how do you change and move the dynamics so that it ultimately results in people doing things differently, but they're motivated based upon their own understanding of how the problem can change based on their intervention. It's one thing to try to do all of this from the top down, and I would love that the compact itself would just simply automatically reveal not just what it says about the standing of students in higher ed, but also then what does one do? I think we're dying in many cases off of the vine of you know, strategy, that we don't always know what to do. And there are some that have demonstrated that they not only know what to do, but they do it in spite of some of the causes of this and some of the problems inherent in it, rather than because of it. And so I'm going to use the compacts as a way of titillating that conversation, spearheading a conversation, opening up the portals of people's thinking about what is possible, both using technology, using different strategies, using collaboration, using new resources, but a way of being able to put our finger on what exactly will be different this year by comparison to the students in prior years. I've had a conversation already about just simply that fact, that this isn't about, you know, you get a pass. There will be no passes when it comes to this, right? This is ultimately about we now have been given the bus we chased. We now have been given an opportunity to do the work, at least I and Rob and lots of other people have been saying we've wanted to do. We now don't get a chance to shift the blame. This is about collective responsibility. And the compacts will be used to usher the conversation about collective responsibility. And ultimately, that is going to be the precursor to a deeper level of accountability as we then go further and further down the road of talking about institutions and the outcomes that they mm-hmm. that they have student by student, year to year.
Thank you. Representative Denver.
Thanks. Following up on this idea of the P20 continuum, I happen to feel that the metaphor of the continuum is actually problematic and, in fact, potentially dangerous. And I say that because, you know, what I definitely approve of the notion of, you know, the OEIB looking at the totality of education, but it fosters a sense that that Oregonians are going to start at P, and they're going to move steadily, mm-hmm. if we're successful, they're going to move steadily mm-hmm. to 20-plus. Right? But in fact, that, in my experience, that's not how life happens, and I don't think it will ever happen that way. If we look at the students, let's just take the subject of remediation. Right? I mean, it would be great if we could assume that if we just invest more in early reading, that will then allow us to not have to worry about students needing remediation when they're in college. I mean, that's the goal. That's the ideal. Mm-hmm. But maybe, who knows, maybe after a number of years we could get to that point. But at present, you know, when I look at our community colleges, for example, and we look at the area of remediation, which is arguably the most challenging, right. you know, part of the community college mission, half of those students, at least, are not coming out of high school. They're people who are in the workforce, who have been right. away from education for many years, and many of whom need really, really significant remediation. And the success rates of those students are quite low right now. And this is not an Oregonian thing. This is a national right. thing. I mean, completion rates at 16%, right. even just to get an associate's degree, or below, actually. And so, you know, somehow we need to remember that. One of the things I like about the 40-40-20 model is that middle 40, mm-hmm. that it reminds us of the importance of that middle 40, those students who we need to get certificates, high-value certificates and degrees. And I want to make sure that is an important part of the conversation, right, that we keep that door open so that when students need to come back to education, there is a place for them, there is funding to do the significant work that is needed to get them the skills that they need.
Thank you. Well taken. Well spoken, sir. Thank you.
Representative Lindsay.
Thank you. I'm impressed. I've been a little hesitant to jump on the bandwagon, and I've been reading the newspaper, but I've been very impressed, and so thank you for your testimony today.
Thank you, sir.
One thing that you mentioned was what I call the maybe the quality. I've been reading a lot lately and studying higher ed and also in just regular ed, and I have, if I'm reading this correctly, Singapore, Japan, I believe Germany, and many, many others, those are just a handful of samples, recruit teachers from the top 10% of their classes. And here in the United States, we recruit from the bottom 20% of classes, if those facts are right. That's what I think it was a McKinsey & Company reported on. In addition to that, our teachers' starting pay is incredibly low, and so we're not attracting those top 10% quality teachers. It's my opinion that we should attract those good quality teachers with higher pay. Also, that we should have some good mentorship, apprenticeship roles for teachers. I know in my profession, a lawyer, I didn't learn anything in law school. I learned it my first 3 years of practicing law. Mm-hmm. It's really an apprenticeship profession, and I believe that's the exact same thing with education. So I think that one way that we do that is we pay teachers based on merit. Am I wrong?
Well, I think there is something to be said for the first portion of what you articulated in terms of your sense that this is about teaching, onboarding younger people coming in as mentors and as interns and the like. I totally agree with that. I don't think that, at least it's not my opinion, that this is ultimately then strengthened or in any way necessarily improved in terms of getting the best and the brightest, if you will, into teaching by then offering additional pay for merit. I think it's a bone of contention. It certainly has been in my last 10 or 12 years. I think it's so contentious that people stay away from it. I don't mean bodies of politicians, but I mean most districts and most people in the industry stay away from it. My druthers would be that we would pay more attention to what the research says, not so much just about the correlation of merit, pay, and quality, but the correlation between quality teaching and support for becoming and becoming a more a stronger and better teacher, that they need to have. We enter the profession for whatever the nickel and dime is that we get paid. We enter the profession fundamentally with two major beliefs. Number one, that we will in fact make an incredibly big difference in someone's life, and the second is that there are opportunities for me to grow in making that difference and to be a better person in the execution of my work as a teacher. The absence of the latter is why people leave after, as the research says, after about the third year. Our turnover rate in this industry is unprecedented in almost any other industry that I've ever studied. And indeed, when you look at this in other countries, when you look at this in China, when you look at this in Japan, if you look at this in other highly developed nations with, if you will, higher scores in NAEP than our own children, what you see is two things that stand out. One, you notice that they are not necessarily paid dramatically more than the United States pays their teachers. Number two, the work they are paid for is noble, powerful, and useful work in the industry. So you have roles of teachers as scholars. You have roles of teachers as developers of curriculum. You have roles of teachers that are essentially held up to their public, to their society, to their state, if you will, as being completely connected to the work of building the economy of that region or of that country. So they have stature. They have the poise, if you will, and the grace that's given to them, not unlike the legal profession, the medical profession, even most cases in the financial industries. And even though we all end up taking our fair share of time in the belly of the bucket of jokes about it, lawyers not exception, teachers are almost at the sort of bottom end of this joke even today, in the sense that they are not thought of as a profession. They don't see themselves, they don't even do work necessarily that's of the kind of work that they're associating with being a profession. And hence, they sort of get reduced down to the lowest common denominator of, well, you only work X number of days out of the year, and so therefore it is what it is. So I have followed some of the same research that you're referring to, sir, and I honestly believe that we can chase the issue of merit pay, and we can run around a mulberry bush about that forever and a day, and we in a lot of places do. I've chosen in my career not to. I do believe in the notion of merit pay. I actually do believe in that, in terms of the way by which people actually should, in fact, be rewarded for certain kinds of accolades of their performance and so forth. But I think that this industry, the public school industry, really needs, before you get to merit pay, get to where the data says we really will make a difference in holding our teachers, which is around the support of there being a profession and a growth that they are feeling like they actually have and can make or manifest themselves during the course of their professional lives.
Just quick follow-up. Thank you. I appreciate that. I agree that apprenticeship is very important. And that's why I brought that up, is the apprenticeship. Yeah. I respectfully disagree that I think it's too late to start the weeding process after they're hired.
Mm-hmm.
I think that we need to get to the top 10%. And if it is not merit pay then, and if we want to improve the honor of the profession, my assumption is the way to do that is to get to recruiting at the top 10%. How do we get there then if it's not merit pay? What is the answer? Or one of the answers?
Sure. If I could.
Certainly.
Co-Chair Johnson, Co-Chair Dembrough, Representative Lindsay, I know that but certainly recruiting highly talented people is very important. And one of the things that we need to do in this state and in all states where we have not done particularly well is to make sure that we recruit the very best of our representative populations. We have a lot of educators who look a lot like me in public schools, and we need to have a lot of educators that look like a lot of the kids that we serve. So that would be another really important part as we talk about who we need to bring into the profession and what that needs to look like. So that's another, it's just another piece of that whole puzzle, and it's a big one. It's a big puzzle. I do think that we have some really interesting models that have taken place in our state with the Class Project. That are really, really nice models of a different way of compensation, and we're kind of at the beginning infancy of looking at those. We have that work going on across the state, but I think it gets to part of what Dr. Crewe is talking about, and that is that as a teacher, really we're talking about people who are profoundly interested in learning. And so as a person who taught, algebra and Algebra 1 for 12 years, there can become a time where, teaching Algebra 1, if a lot of educators want to be about lifelong learning, there wasn't a lot of learning left for me to do in algebra. I had that down really, really well. But where there was a lot of room for me for learning was in my profession as a teacher, mm-hmm. in the pedagogy, in the way that I taught kids to learn that subject in a way that would have them engage and be excited about coming back to class the next day for Algebra 1. And that's a neat trick, mm-hmm. right? And so one of the things I think that the Class Project does is it engages people around their professional practice of being a high-quality teacher, and it changes some compensation schedule about that and how people engage in that. And so And that is a really nice model. It's one that we have that already exists in the state. It's one that we're rolling out in additional places in the state and that we can need to continue to look at and use as an opportunity to make sure that we're really good about teaching teachers to be great teachers. And so I think, I hope that that speaks a little bit to what Dr. Crew was saying and gets at your question a little bit. So there's a different kind of compensation model that's different than merit pay, if merit pay is going to be predicted on what kind of outcomes are achieved on a set of tests, which is a big challenge because the material that you're working with is variable.
Well, I would just add that I think what both of you guys are alluding to is successful, robust professional development opportunities to pour into the teachers, and that just lends itself, again, puts an exclamation mark behind the importance of successfully implementing the educator evaluation systems called for in Senate Bill 290, and that will be the item that's on the plate of every 196 school districts coming out this next year, and that's why it's so important for the department and everybody to get OSBA, all those entities to get together and help that happen. So I'm going to go to Representative Hunt real quick.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Really appreciate, I think we all appreciate the major roles that you're taking on. You're obviously coming into a environment that has been pretty resource-starved. Rob knows that firsthand. I'm sure you are quickly, I'm sure you were aware of it even before you took on the task. And it seems like we've done a really good job on the early childhood end of the spectrum at setting high expectations, both structurally and in terms of achievement goals, and plowing resources in to match those high expectations. The class project that you mentioned is an example where they've set specific goals and plowed resources into to meeting those goals. Are you worried? I'll ask it two ways. Are you worried about looking at the budget forecast? Are you concerned about being able to match the necessary resources to go along with those heightened expectations on kids and parents and teachers and administrators? And I guess the other side of the coin is, are you committed to making sure that those heightened expectations and goals are really married with the resources to make sure that that all those folks are successful?
I presume it's me.
Either of you, yeah.
You want to take it first?
Started the buck stops here.
I am certainly committed to making sure that we raise the level of resource allocation commensurate with what we ultimately say we want to do and then do. So in an outcome-based world, not to overuse the term, but you want there to be a relationship between effort and earning. You want there to be a relationship between the outcomes that we actually are in the process of getting and beginning to show evidence of getting and the level of funding. Part of the attraction of this work for me was it sort of assumes, without it getting into the gnarliness of, you know, everybody having to be in everybody's backyard, but it assumes that there are things that people are doing that actually make a huge difference. And we need to scale that up. Sure. And so a lot of those, for lack of a better term, I think of those as strategic investments. Mm-hmm. What is it that when you do it in 10 places, it still works? In 197 places, it still works. Even given their own version of it, it still works. It puts young people in a higher leveraged position in terms of their learning. Well, I'm committed to asking for the money for that. I'm committed to that. Now, I've been around the horn. I've been to places where people look at you and City Council of New York or wherever it may be, and they'll look at you and say, "Yeah, so what?" Right? I'm not going to make some of the same mistakes I made in that world where I keep asking, right? But I do think I'm going to bring it to you and leave it at your doorstep, if you will, and humbly said, be a servant of the governor's, you know, desire to make this work and sort of be willing to have the long, late night, back door, wherever the conversations have to be, in order to chase this to the fact, to the reality of being able to do it. Now, I came with that in my heart. Nobody, this isn't about, you know, how it works in Oregon versus how it works in any place. This is just because there are children involved, and I think we have a duty, a moral obligation to be able to chase this and to answer all the hard questions, the soft questions, whatever else those questions are, but to answer them. But when they answered, to then step up to the plate and fund what we know works for these young people. So I'm committed to that without a doubt. And yes, I do worry about the perseveration over we don't have any money, and so therefore nothing can, I can't do it.
Right.
It can't be done. I'll only be able to do it if I get the money. I just don't buy that. I just don't buy it. I think that that's a reason for failure. That's an excuse. So I have never in my life, in my career, let that be the basis for my success or failure. If we need more money, I'm going to ask. If we need more attention and focus, I'm going to demand. If we need more collaboration, he and I are going to ultimately talk. If we need to figure out new and different ways of being able to build the architecture so that we don't lose kids in the transition points, then we have to do that. So this is, in my mind, like this is one of these rare opportunities in life where you really get what you ask for. You know, I've wanted to do something like this all my career. This is the last time I'll probably ever get in my career a chance to do something like this. So to paint it right, to get it really right one time, and then go fishing or go whatever one's going to do after this is exactly right. But I'd love to have this one opportunity where we actually act like we mean all means all. All the ELL kids, all the kids with special needs, all the kids who are nameless, if you will, but have program titles over their head from Title I to Title VII and on and on and on. It just defies me that in this nation we wouldn't spend the kind of time and effort to do this as a body politic. So, yeah, I'm deeply committed to that. And part of the reason that I really wanted to work with Rob, to be perfectly honest with you, was I didn't know him before I came here, but I just heard about, you know, the fact that this is an A player. So you only want to play with players who actually want to win. So this is for the first time, you know, you're closer in this state than any place ever I've seen in my career. And I understand the money is what the money is, right? But that's, in my mind, solvable once we start producing things by way of results that mm-hmm. make sense for people, that the public can feel like, wow, this is now different. My kid is doing better. I do see evidence of this in my own home. And then you get... Then it loosens up. The economy will not be this bad forever. It just won't be. I mean, I hope I've answered your question, sir. But that's kind of what we both talk about all the time, and how when I've met with the governor, it's sort of what he has asked for us to hold, which is the faith that this will make a difference, and you know, that's the way we're going to approach it.
Senator.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Dr. Crew, it's a pleasure to see you again. We had the pleasure of meeting for about an hour yesterday afternoon. Mr. Saxon, it's a pleasure to see you again. You know, it's interesting. You may know that in my other life, I'm a physician, and I'm a physician educator. I've spent the past 25 years educating those who have chosen the profession after me. And the more I listen to what I'm hearing, the more I think about the analogies between ongoing medical education, the continuing medical education that I pay a lot of attention to now, those of us who are out of our training, and I would agree completely with Representative Lindsay. I learned a lot in medical school, but boy, did I learn a lot in residency. And I think that kind of ongoing mentoring and on the real on-the-job training where you combine responsibility with appropriate supervision is critical. And the lifelong learning that you refer to is also critical. One of the frustrations that we face a lot in medicine is the, well, my patients are different, right? And I think you alluded to that to some extent. And the question that I asked a lot during the Senate Education and Workforce Development Committee hearings in February when we were passing Senate Bill 1581 for the Achievement Compact is, well, how exactly are you going to share these best practices? And how are you going to help people understand that, yeah, you may have to tweak things a little bit based on your students, but there are some real similarities between McMinnville and the students of the Native American communities where they're, even though right. there are different significant differences, too, that we need to appreciate and recognize. And how do we find that right balance between saying, look, it's expensive, time-consuming, and unnecessary to reinvent the wheel when we know what good practices are, and yet we understand that you know better than anybody else what's going on in your community and how you need to tweak this. So if you could comment on that a little bit. I have a whole host of other questions, but I'll start with that one.
Go ahead.
Thank you very much. I appreciate that, Senator. The way I view the dissemination, what we have right now is we have a dissemination problem. It's conceivable that one could have an exciting school in McMinnville, but we don't know how to actually replicate that or design or do that in 197 other places or 196 other places. The way that I think of that task is to harness the research, the policy, the practice, capture it and capture the knowledge around it, using the people who are actually executing it, ask them to decode, if you will, the knowledge base of what they did, how they did it, and then begin the process of bringing others to the net, putting it in a network of other educators where they get the benefit of what that petri dish of work look like. In a prior life, I had the occasion of being in a business in a for-profit area where, as new and different product came out, it was made available to lots and lots of people within a state. But the places where it was really, really being absorbed and used, the company would bring in large numbers of the sales force and some of the heads of that and begin to talk about how they're talking about this in the sector, in the private sector. And all of us would sit and listen and begin to understand, well, how that might sound in my community, or how might we sell more in our community by virtue of the way that this model is actually laying out before us. Well, I kind of feel the same is true about reading strategy, that we've got to actually capture it, talk about it, put it on a network, give other people entree to it. And I think colleges of education, when you heard me speak about this before, from a research standpoint, from a policy standpoint, from an incubation of ideas standpoint, from a dissemination standpoint, colleges of education, in my mind, have an enormous property, if you will, of being able to do this work and do it well. I think that the Department of Education has enormous properties of being able to do this work and aggregate new knowledge and the practitioners together to look at this work. We have the agencies to be able to do this under our tent, so to speak. They are there. They are our teaching hospitals, if you will. We have the best, some of the best schools in the nation. As I said, I had an opportunity to meet with one of the principals today, and I asked her, do you ever talk with the other principals in your school? Yes. I get to present in my district to all of the incoming assistant principals, the people who are just fresh out of a classroom, perhaps, and going into their first administrative body of work. Well, we need to do that for the whole state. There's really not a vehicle for doing it for the state, to be perfectly honest with you, but that's part of the job right now of creating that. And I'm simply saying you've got the pieces in terms of colleges of education. Community colleges are there. You've got really good practice and good dissemination networks out of the ODE, or at least the possibility of building that. And frankly, you've got districts themselves. The districts are great petri dishes of exactly the kind of practice we want to see. I would hope at one point to actually bring in examples of the best reading instruction that we've seen in the state of Oregon. So you really could see what that really looks like. This is an industry that hasn't done very much of that, and so we've left people bereft of seeing what an A performance looks like from an English teacher or a math teacher or an algebra teacher.
Thank you.
Thank you both. I think we need to... Representative, this will be our last question.
Thank you. I'm sure I've been very inspired by your words, and I assume I'll be inspired by your deeds when we talk about time. But I was particularly inspired by your statement about teachers. I have a daughter that I think is a master teacher and is retiring at much too early an age, because she said she'd like to do something that she would be appreciated for, like perhaps being a barista at Starbucks. I mean, that sort of cynicism is just it's just awful. And one of the causes of that, I think, has to do with a particular problem. There are some really terrible teachers haunting some of the buildings. It's one or two in a building, and they essentially destroy the environment for everybody else, because everybody else has to pick up worrying about, are their kids going to go into that class next year, worrying about how they're going to make up for the fact that their kids were in that class last year. When I talk to the teachers' union, when I talk to the boards, I say we have to find a way to deal with getting rid of these teachers that are just poisoning some of the buildings. And I don't know how to do it, but it's something that I think it's partly relating to the responsibility of the principals in the building. It's really hard. Those of us that have worked in big organizations know how hard it is to deal with progressive discipline. It takes a lot of time and a lot of effort, but we need to find a way to support those principals, I think, in dealing with these, I'm talking about one or two teachers right in the building, and they can just so disrupt the environment.
Right. I couldn't agree more, and I think that just as an axiom, I've never been in a really, really poor performing school, but that I didn't also see an absence of principal engagement in really looking at and examining and holding accountable all teachers across the board. And I think that some of these words have become sort of bad words in our current parlance, that this has not always been an easy conversation to have, but I do believe that it's time for us to actually accept the reality that, as you say, that there are, whether they're administrators or superintendents or teachers, there are the sort of bandwidth of the 1%, 2%, I don't know what the numbers are, but there's a small minority of people who, frankly, shouldn't be in the core. They long since lost their heart. They long since lost their dedication to young people. And they really are, in fact, an obstruction to the work of transformation. And we've been reluctant as an industry to take that on. Now, I don't think anybody wants to, you know, sort of lose their feet in the process of that. So we have to be smart about what that looks like. I think supervision is a starting point for really pointing in the right direction as to what should there be more of in a school. But when I've talked with principals, what they've said is, I don't really know how to do that. So I don't really even understand how to have the conversation about that performance. I can't really look at that classroom lesson and say that wasn't good because I don't know how to look at a lesson. And so as a result, it just goes on, and we rate people, and we give people a pass, in effect, and the culture then gets sick. The culture gets sick because it allows the best to actually have no distinguishing characteristics from the worst. And that culture won't survive. So when you hear us talking about working with these schools, that's code, if you will. And that's code for getting in people's face over what they have to do differently to actually cause this distinction of really good behavior
versus really bad behavior? And how do we help everybody move toward a point where, if they want to, if they've got the will, and that's what I meant about the development and support, if they want to and they have the will, they can get better. And that's why I think that this is going to have to be a conversation that is sort of at all three sort of levels of this. But we can't back away from it. And as I said before, this is kind of the moment when we get a chance to do it right. Frankly, I have, in many cases in my own career, you know, just sort of looked at some of these problems and not gotten it right. This is now a time to get this right. So I'm saying to superintendents, I'm going to say to their boards, don't back away from the breach. Step into the breach. My judgment of you is going to be predicated upon how strongly and smartly you stand in the breach for these children. And you articulate what is wrong. You give people a chance to improve. You send them to whatever support structures there are to help and enable them to be far better at this. Not presuming anything about this other than the best, that they want to do this and that they will do it. But failing to do it means that you actually do have, at that point in time, a responsibility to discharge your duties in discharging them. And I suspect that you're going to find people, you know, and everybody already knows who they are, whether they're principals and teachers or superintendents, everybody already knows who they are. And the institution that's sick is the one that basically knows who they are and then sees every year that they're still there. I'm a lot of things, but I won't be letting that ride. I won't.
Thanks again.
Thank you.
I'm sure that I know that the days and weeks and months to come hold the promise of some exciting outcomes for Oregon, and we'll be hearing from both of you frequently, I hope. So thanks for being here today.
Thank you so much.
You.
With that, we'll call up a couple other individuals to continue our discussion about financial aid. Two members from the Treasurer's Department, Tom Reinhardt and Michael Salvaggio.
And Mr. Chair, while they're coming up, colleagues, if I could point out to you on your desks, we passed out this latest publication from WICHE, the Western Interstate Commission on Higher Education, talking about where we are now in the 15 Western states in terms of tuition rates and tuition increases for two-year schools and four-year schools. You'll see just quickly in the graphs that Oregon is the fourth highest tuition rate for its public universities. Actually, its 7% increase from last year was among the lower ones of the Western states, but our rate is still up at the top. And for the community colleges, we are the third most expensive in the West. And our rate of increase last year was $400, and that is, again, the third highest. And that is directly related to declines in state allocation to the universities and to the two-year schools throughout the West.
Please. Good afternoon, Co-Chair Denbrough, Co-Chair Johnson, Chair Haas, members of the committee. My name is Tom Reinhardt. I'm proud to be Chief of Staff for State Treasurer Ted Wheeler. Ted had a scheduling conflict and could not be here today. He sends his regrets. My colleagues and I are here to present an idea that we believe moves Oregon closer to the state we all want it to be. A state in which businesses have the trained workforce they need to take risks and expand. A state in which our families see steady increases in their wages because they are competitive in the modern economy in terms of training and education. A state in which students and families have a reliable, affordable path for receiving training, community college, or a four-year degree, which we believe is a critical component to achieving the 40-40-20 plan that you and your colleagues have outlined. Our ambitious target of having 40% of our residents graduate from a four-year institution, 40% from community college, and 20% from high school. To move ourselves towards this vision, we propose the Opportunity Initiative. The Opportunity Initiative creates a permanent fund to help Oregonians pay for job training and post-secondary education. Our objective today is to give you a very brief background for why we are making this proposal, knowing that you know a lot of that information already, describe what it is, and offer you a potential roadmap for how we get there. So first, why the Opportunity Initiative? Three main reasons. Reason number one, rising costs for students and their families. Like you probably heard earlier today, I know that Josette went over some of this. According to the Oregon University System, tuition and fees have risen 50% over the last 7 years. If we went around the room, I bet we have stories from people in the room about how they're trying to face those in their own families. Soaring student debt is reason number two. As reported recently in many different reports, Oregonians at public and private nonprofit institutions accumulated on average $24,000 in debt pursuing their degrees. Again, if we went around this room, myself included, a lot of us are still facing debt from years ago when the rates were lower. It's a lot harder now. Third, drop in financial public support for post-secondary education institutions. No one knows this better than the people on the committee in front of me. In Oregon, the state contribution to public universities has declined 27% over the last decade. And I know that, I think you have charts in front of you, even though we're having technical problems here. As it stands today, we're in the bottom third in the nation in terms of state contribution. The truth here is that there's been a steady cost shift in tuition assistance from the state's general fund to our students and families. So what does this mean for Oregon, and why is the treasurer proposing a different approach? Oh, we got the chart up now. Excuse me for a minute. So I wanted to point out one thing on this chart before I go forward, and that is if you look at this, we see that the inflation baseline actually shows that the costs in the OU, that the OUS gave us in terms of their costs and how they're rising really track with inflation, which we were surprised at. The real issue that we have here is that obviously the student costs have risen much faster than inflation, although the underlying costs have stayed the same, the system's actual costs. We were surprised by that research and wanted to share it with you. So back again, what does this mean for Oregon, and why is the treasurer interested in this, and what's the underlying rationale for making a proposal to you to consider? This is not simply a problem for people struggling to pay for education and training, although that is a very serious issue. Treasurer Wheeler, if he was sitting with us here, would say clearly he believes it will be difficult, if not impossible, to steadily increase per capita income if job training of all types and post-secondary ed continues to become less and less affordable. We want to be clear that we're not saying here that everyone needs a college degree, but the direct link between long-term earning potential and any training beyond a high school degree is growing each year. And again, we have a chart here of data that you've probably seen in different forms. In addition to the connection to per capita wage growth, the link between the number of highly trained and educated people in a community and a state and the inverse relationship with state services is undeniable. It's proven again and again. Again, another chart that shows you that. The more education you have, the less drain you are on social services. As a former chair of Multnomah County, Oregon's most populous county, Ted saw firsthand as he managed the social service and public safety infrastructure the direct link between a person's education achievement and their need for services. And as someone who wrestled with Ted on the budget process there year after year, I can attest to that as well. It is through that lens and experience that the treasurer has pushed us to view job training, vocational education, community colleges, and four-year schools as one of our smartest public investments. So the Opportunity Initiative. The Opportunity Initiative will use a responsible portion of bonding capacity to build a permanent fund over the next 30 years, a fund dedicated to strengthening the state's investment in financial aid for job training programs and post-secondary education. Thank you for your attention. I'm going to turn it to my colleague, Mike Salvaggio. He's going to walk us through the steps of how we think we could get there.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Michael Salvaggio from the Office of the State Treasurer. I'd like to start out describing the financial objectives of this program, then move on to how we get there. I figured we might have some time for questions, and we brought Michael Burdick from our office up here, has done a lot of detailed research on the financial figures. Firstly, to address the rising cost of post-secondary tuition and fees, and to also get at the unpredictability issue that Representative Greenlick mentioned earlier, we have a goal of creating a permanent fund with revenue sufficient to cover the anticipated needs gap of 2 years post-secondary education for all Oregon students. And this is a moving target because as we go out 20 to 30 years, the number is going to change with cost increases and anticipated growth in student age populations. But our best projections at this point, given conservative estimates on interest rates and fund growth, are that we have the following aim: to generate a revenue of just under $300 million per year in 30 years, and thusly build a fund over that time period of $6 billion, assuming a disbursement of a rolling 5%. To build it, we're recommending that the fund be seeded in the coming biennium with $500 million bonding capacity, which, given our expectations currently, is well within the state's prudent debt limits. Like a personal 529 college savings plan, more money in earlier means more interest earnings and is cheaper in the long run. So combining that with historically low interest rates this year, starting this fund with a significant deposit now could save money down the road. In subsequent biennium, we anticipate a series of smaller requests. And I want to stress right now that this is a very flexible plan. We are not binding future legislatures to a particular financial course or even to a mandated particular outcome. This fund is not on autopilot. It is expected to be and will be adjusted and adapted as circumstances require. So this slide is one example of a roadmap to building this permanent fund. In this example, those little tiny blue bars are the state's anticipated contributions over the next 30 years. In this example, we've built in some tough assumptions for interest rates, earnings, and we're assuming an eventual backing out of general fund dollars for the existing opportunity grant. It's relatively aggressive early on to account for those factors and to save money down the road. But as I said earlier, future legislatures will not be bound to this plan, so this map will be flexible and reevaluated even past the point when I hope to retire. So, to set us down this path, we will be submitting two pieces of legislation to the 2013 legislature. Firstly, a joint resolution to create a permanent fund for this purpose in the Oregon Constitution to be used only for student assistance. And second, to allow the legislature to issue bonds for deposit into that fund. If passed by the legislature, the measure would be placed before voters at some point before June of 2014, almost certainly either in November or May. At the same time, next session, we will request a statutory measure that will set up the technical construct around bond issuance, deposit, and repayment, set up administrative statutes within an existing agency, and at that same time ask them to explore the possibility of various incentives. So regarding the issue that Representative Lindsay mentioned earlier about how do we incentivize throughput, this would be, I think, the proper way to hook it into this program. We take the administrative agency and say develop around this program some recommendation of how we can incentivize throughput through these awards. Statutorily, at this point, the fund is similar to the Common School Fund, which is a constitutionally protected trust fund managed by a statutory agency, in that case the Department of State Lands, in this case still under discussion. Finally, the bill would contain the authorization for $500 million in bonds to be issued for deposit into that fund. And this statutory piece's effectiveness is entirely contingent upon the ballot measure passing, so not a dime gets spent without an endorsement from the voters. So assuming that both measures pass and the ballot measure passes, bonds would be sold sometime in 2014 to 2015. We're anticipating two separate sales of $250 million each. After the first year of generating revenue, we'll be able to increase the existing opportunity grant program by 50% as soon as that corpus begins kicking out interest. Over the next 30 years, assuming regular deposits, revenue will grow with debt service and track very closely. After 30 years, debt service will begin dropping off as the fund corpus and the resulting revenue continue to grow. At the end of 30 years, the state will have incurred financial benefits of just under double the amount of the aggregate debt service that we've paid out. So over the next several months, Treasury staff is going to continue to discuss what should and should not be included with this program. We'll continue to refine our projections and assumptions, and hopefully by the time session opens, we'll be able to get much more accurate numbers to put in front of you, although estimating for 30 years out is no easy task. And we'll be discussing how this ought to fit in with both our existing programs and processes, and also what other incentives we want to build around higher education that this committee may find interesting and has discussed some today. But as I said earlier, We hope to have much more precise numbers at the start of session. The only thing I can say with certainty right now is that the projections that we've made for 30 years out are not spot on. That's the only promise we're going to make. But as I said earlier, the program's at no point on autopilot, and it will be maintained closely. And very importantly, it will be weighed against other priorities. We think this is a worthy priority for students as well as the state, but it's going to have to be balanced with the legislature's other responsibilities as well. So thank you for your time, and we'll now take any questions you may have.
Okay, thank you guys for your presentation. Any comments, questions?
I have a couple of questions. Sure. Thanks. Thank you. This is a very exciting proposal. And I just want to drill into a couple of the details. So the hope is that, you know, down the road we would have a $200 million or so would be what this fund could produce. And what would the payout be in the early years? Have some projections been made for that? I mean, what would be the immediate impact on the amount we would have available for opportunity grants?
Chair Denbrough, members of the committee, the anticipation is that after the fund has at least 1 year to begin generating interest, we'll be able to seed, I say seed, but I mean deposit $25 million per year into the existing opportunity grant program just with what we're asking for in 2014-2015. Combining that each year with an additional amount, plus the fact that we're not cycling all of the earnings out into opportunity grants, some of those go back and help build the fund, that's going to grow every year. And the let me just go back to the model that I put in front of you right here. This is an example of something that grows that that revenue very steadily. Without a lot of jumps or gaps. So that would be essentially a straight line through 2043, getting from $25 million up to $300. I couldn't tell you in any given year what it would be, but we can certainly generate those numbers fairly easily if you have any follow-up.
I think that would be useful. And one other question that I have. So. You mentioned that, you know, your goal here is to use this plan to provide the resources, and then, you know, this body, the appropriate agencies, you know, OSAC, HEC, et cetera, could look into ways of using, perhaps redesigning the opportunity grant, the need-based aid grant, in order to make best use of these resources. You know, in the document here in the frequently asked questions section, you know, it talks about incentives for on-time completion and incentives for STEM degrees. Mm-hmm. Is that what you were referring to? Is that those are potential things that wouldn't be a required part of the program, but those are things that that we could consider in terms of how we're redesigning those programs.
Co-Chair Denbrough, members of the committee. Yes, I'm smiling to myself because I'm thinking of, you knew know we have a very opinionated state treasurer, and he will share his opinions with you about what he believes could be used as incentives, like Representative Lindsay mentioned, or elements of the program. However, we also know that a lot of other very smart, dedicated people are working on this, including some people in front of me on different committees regarding STEM and other components of the way that this grant could be strengthened. We want to prioritize our efforts on creating the resource mechanism, a permanent fund, mm-hmm. and we will participate as invited in other conversations, but we don't think that's where our most value added is for you in this process.
What would this do to the state's overall bonded indebtedness? How would it impact that, what you're proposing?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the anticipated debt capacity for the next year, and I use the term anticipated very loosely because I am not the Debt Policy Advisory Commission, will likely, if I had to guess, be around $1.2 billion. Now, that is for general obligation debt, so this would in no way cut against transportation dollars, lottery dollars, which are from entirely separate pools of money. So given the general obligation pool of $1.2 billion, you know, clearly this would be $500 million of that for this coming biennium. In out years, it clearly gets more difficult to anticipate what our capacity is going to be, because that's going to be due in large part on, based in large part on interest rates. It's going to be based on the state's revenue, and that's where I get to the point, the saying that this is not on autopilot. We're going to have to manage that very closely. So I can tell you what it would do to debt service in the coming biennium. I can't tell you what it would do much further than that.
Co-Chair Johnson, can I add one thing to that?
Certainly.
Thank you, Mike. There's one thing that we always want to add into the conversation is that that projection that Mike gave you on debt capacity, $1.2 billion, that is the level at which we'd still be under our 5% conservative bonding cap that is self-imposed, but that in no way spending all that money with legislatively appropriated projects, we'd still be under our cap. I just want to make sure that that's clear.
Thank you.
Senator. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Salvaggio, Mr. Reinhart, one of the questions as I look at that graph is not only what's the actual growth of the fund with appropriate investment strategies, but also when you think about the long-term income potential of people with higher education, obviously it's much higher than those who only achieve a high school degree. And as we think about this going forward, I'd be very interested, understanding that it's difficult to predict based on how we structure revenue for this state, which won't necessarily stay the same 30 years from now as it is now, be interested to hear a little bit about how you think that revenues to the state from taxes based on higher incomes and increased discretionary income, things like that, and in terms of adding to the economy, might change with this kind of an investment. It's a trickier number to wrap your mind hands around, and I don't expect exact estimates. But as we go forward, I'd be very interested in your thoughts about that as well.
Co-chairs, Senator Steiner Hayward, thanks for the question. We are interested in that. We have some data from urban areas that have been sketched out by various entities. We could try to give you some sample data.
That'd be helpful. Thank you very much.
I'm just curious how you do project an assumed earnings growth. What's your...
Of the fund?
Yeah. What's your magic ball you're utilizing for that?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, much has been discussed of our magic ball in recent months. As this would be a very long-term fund run on the same kind of model as the endowment of the Common School Fund, very long term, like the pension fund, we would be investing it similarly, or I should say, the Oregon Investment Council will. The we have built in an assumed earnings rate which averages 7% a year over 30 years. So that's very comparable and actually somewhat conservative when placed against earnings from the pension fund, which have been exceeding, comfortably exceeding 7%. I don't want to step in anything right here.
Yeah, careful.
The benefit to this fund is that we do not have the we do not have these returns spiked with the 2008 losses. So this is going to, I think, be a little easier to hit its target on average.
Okay.
What was that number?
7%.
Senator, or Representative Harker, pardon me.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A couple of quick questions. The Student Opportunity Fund would be constitutionally locked and protected. Does that bar us from sweeping those funds at times when we get hungry?
Co-Chairs, Representative Harker, I think that's a fair assessment of that. Yes.
Okay, both of the good desire and the bar.
And Mr. Chair, members of the committee, if I could just add to that, if the legislature so desires, it may ask the people of the state of Oregon for a draw.
Okay. Thank you. Follow up?
Yes, sir.
The other one is there's description of or mention of the organization that would manage the funds and make decisions about the incentives and other things. What is that organization and who's on it? And
Mr. Chair,
and,
Representative
and.
Parker. Currently, the Oregon Student Assistance Commission manages the Opportunity Grant. We are privy to conversations around, there are people interested in all different configurations in the years ahead of how we do this work, the Education Investment Board, the HEC. So we purposely are remaining agnostic about who manages it, knowing that in your world, our world, things will change on the education landscape. Mm-hmm. We want to make clear that Treasury has no interest in managing the actual program and that we're not experts at that. We believe the Investment Council and our investment division should be obviously investing the funds, which that is our expertise. So hope that clarifies it for you.
So the assumption is that it would be OSAC?
That's right, unless otherwise directed by the legislature.
Okay.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. You know, in some ways, what we're talking about here is reminiscent of the plan that was proposed by the University of Oregon a couple of years ago to deal with the University of Oregon. And one thing that, you know, I think is attractive about this plan is it would be open to students all over the state. But one element of the U of O proposal that was also interesting was that the state bonding investment was matched to some extent by philanthropy. And can you envision a scenario in which philanthropy might have a role to play in this? And I said, I know that Washington State is just beginning a new program that is doing that kind of public-private match, I think for STEM scholarships. And do you see a potential for the fund being open to that kind of thing?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, yes, we do. And in the discussions that we've had with Legislative Council in drafting the joint resolution, we are allowing for the deposit of philanthropic funds into the trust. The how that is going to match up to practical effects and withdrawals, I think, is something that is going to bear a slightly larger discussion at the legislative level and at the administrative level. How do we structure an incentive to where, you know, you can put funds in? Can you designate that for a particular campus? If so, do you get some kind of match from the corpus that's earmarked for that campus? We don't really know the answer to that offhand at this point, but we have allowed for that concept to hook in.
Thank you.
Follow up on Chair Dunbar's question, that I think would be a powerful kind of incentive. I mean, as both the legislature and voters are looking at this, I would encourage you to at least begin that conversation with foundations or others to see if there's any way to at least get some early commitments, maybe then with some possible openness to additional commitments. But that, if I think that really, because that leverages more dollars, gets you to those goals faster. I don't know what those incentives would look like, but that seems like that's worthy of conversation on the front end, in addition to continuing to leave those opportunities open on the back end.
Mr. Chair, may I speak to that? Representative Hunt, thank you for that. I want to assure you that conversations have occurred.
Great.
And I think I can be blunt in saying that this conversation and your very gentle challenge will help encourage those conversations along. When people know that you're interested in us developing that, I think that will help us very much. Thank you.
Any other comments, questions?
Thanks, you guys. It's an intriguing concept. I'm sure we'll hear more about that.
Thank you for your time.
Thank you to the treasurer, too, for sending you. Josette, do you want to come back up just briefly here? There might be a couple more questions, and we definitely will have us out of here before 5 o'clock. I guarantee that.
So, Josette, first of all, how would you like some more money?
I'll tell you. I'm Josette Green, Executive Director of OSAC, and I know the governor is very Much wants to infuse the program with more funding. I know he has not yet made a decision on the concept that Treasury has brought forward, but I know that there is a very real desire for more funding for our students. So,
yes. I just wanted to ask a couple things. First of all, in terms of eligibility for the grant and so forth, you currently don't take into account at all the type of degree or the type of program that a student's involved in, do you?
Yeah, Mr. Co-Chair, you're correct. We do not look
Can
at the
you
degree
envision
of the
yourself at some point in time operating in an arena like that, i.e., if in fact we as a state move towards, let's say, incentivizing participation in certain degree areas that are likely to provide a better living for the recipient, if you will, but also a better contribution to Oregon's job force? I mean, we just heard Rudy talk about some things via achievement compacts. It could, in fact, you know, I'm just saying, there could be some things that could come down the pike, so to speak, in years to come that could move us in that direction. Can you envision being able to operate in that sort of an arena?
Those decisions would be decisions that we could honor if this body indeed made that decision. So from the operational standpoint, we certainly can do the appropriate changes or redesign to be able to accommodate that.
Do you have any performance criteria right now for degree for the grant recipients in terms of academic performance to be able to maintain that or to be able to reapply for it and so forth?
Yeah, Mr. Co-Chair, that's an excellent question. And as you know, with the Task Force on Higher Education, mm-hmm. Student and Institutional Success, we've been delving into that and asking those questions. And sadly, we do not have that kind of data or information at this point in time. The research component of the agency was removed several years ago, mm-hmm. and the ability to research has been hindered.
Okay.
So we do not have that information.
Representative,
if I could just follow up on that. This is a debate that's happening around the country. And, you know, I mentioned before I was just at a WICHE meeting, and there was a session on this. And, you know, some states are actually moving away from their need-based aid programs, moving more in the direction of merit-based aid. I personally deplore that move. This is... You know, I think there's a lot of discussion around this, and I think we will have to have, you know, this conversation over the next year. You know, I think there are arguments on all sides of this issue.
Mm-hmm.
I personally don't agree with the notion of targeting towards specific disciplines, but I think it's definitely something worth talking about.
Mm-hmm. Representative Springer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And you brought up a point that I have not given much time or thought to. So a student applies for all of their aid on their FAFSA, and they may or may not receive the opportunity grant, and they may or may not do well in past classes. And then the next year, they would have that same opportunity to on their FAFSA to apply for everything, including the opportunity grant, and again be awarded the opportunity grant.
Representative Springer, thank you for the question. That's correct. Each year, students reapply for financial aid, and so the opportunity starts all over again to receive the funding. So, yes, in the current spectrum, financial aid is based that way. I want to say thank you also for continuing to be an Aspire mentor. That has been very valuable to your students and to our agency. Thank
and
you.
And to me. Okay, got to do a plug. I wasn't going to go there.
Go ahead.
I did this publicly a couple times last session. We all can find a little bit of time to mm-hmm. be Aspire volunteers. I had, I think, 19 kids last year. It was a blast. I didn't meet with them individually. And the last meeting they had, we, and I mean this in all seriousness, we at this dais have incredible opportunity to get people at Aspire. I made a handful of calls and got a local CPA, got a local fire lieutenant, got a bunch of folks at the next meeting and signed up. And we have, because they didn't want to tell us no. So we've got great ability to do that, and we need to do that. Well, they didn't want to tell me no for some reason, but they were there.
Well said. Aspire is a terrific program, and in our district, it's paying some tremendous dividends, and we're moving it down to the middle school level because that's really where we have to start those conversations.
Mm-hmm. Wonderful.
Can I just ask a clarifying question? Going back to the question of student whether they're able to reapply, Don't they need to remain in good academic standing in order to get the degree, to get the grant?
Yes. Mr. Co-Chair and Representative Dembro, you're absolutely right. They do need to stay in good standing. And as I heard the question, I was making some assumptions there. But you're right. Every student needs to be in standing with satisfactory academic progress as defined by the institution for the student to continue for the next year.
Representative Hunt? One question about one of your slides, the one that said 2012-13 full need student. It has two different columns, and it's been 25 years since I filled out the FAFSA form, although this year I'm going to get to know much better. but it shows a difference in the student share depending on, I don't know if it's the type of university or the length of university. I thought the student share, at least as FAFSA looks at it, is fixed based on the student savings and some assumptions about what the student is going to earn in summers before entering. Am I misreading this? I thought this, the student and family share were kind of fixed items, but I'm seeing them as different here.
Mr. Co-Chair, Representative Hunt, from the federal financial aid perspective, you're absolutely right. That is what happens through filling out the FAFSA. One then receives an EFC and information as to what the expected contribution is from the family. And then we have the shared responsibility model, which is this state's definition. So those aspects of student share are defined differently than for the federal financial aid. And in this state, the student share is a combination of an expectation of working 15 hours a week for 48 weeks, and $3,000 of loan component for the four-year institutions. So it's just the federal government and our state have two different definitions on that.
Well,
you're looking at me.
I'm ready to be done.
Yeah.
Thanks, Joseph. Appreciate your time.
You're very welcome. Thank you for having me here today.
It's been a long 3 days.
We're out of practice.
Yes, it has.
I'm ready to head for the barn. With that, we'll go ahead and adjourn the House Interim Committee on Higher Ed.
And we'll adjourn the Senate Committee on Education and Workforce Development.